I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The Republican presidential campaign touches down in Pennsylvania again today as Ohio Governor John Kasich holds a Center City fundraiser ahead of a town hall meeting in Hershey tomorrow. WHYY's Dave Davies looks at Kasich's effort to attract local Republicans whose earlier choices have dropped out.
John Kasich hasn't accumulated a ton of delegates in the Republican sweepstakes, but he is one of three candidates still standing. Muhlenberg College political scientist Chris Borick says the Ohio governor is banking a lot on doing well in Pennsylvania, where he has family ties and is the governor of a neighboring state.
You have a chance that he could win it. For John Kasich, it would be enormous to win a state other than his home state, to give him another level of credibility going into the convention in his home state of Cleveland this summer.
A recent Pennsylvania poll shows Kasich running in second place in Pennsylvania, just 3 points behind Donald Trump. To gain momentum, Kasich needs to pick up the support of party leaders and fundraisers in the state who'd backed candidates who've since dropped out. Manny Stamatakis is an insurance executive who was Pennsylvania finance chairman for the Jeb Bush campaign. He's among those who sponsored Kasich's Philadelphia fundraiser. He says if no candidate has the delegates for a first ballot win at the convention, delegates will have to make a decision.
You will have to focus on a candidate that can win in November. And I haven't seen any polls that show Donald Trump winning in November, and I think that's a negative. I've seen polls saying that the person that beats Hillary the best so far is Kasich.
The Ted Cruz campaign is also reaching out to Pennsylvania Republicans, telling them that Cruz is the only candidate with a hope of stopping Trump, and thus a vote for Kasich is wasted. In effect, a vote for Trump.
Well, that's a lot of hot air from the Cruz campaign.
Charlie Dent is a congressman from Allentown who was an early Kasich supporter. He says neither Cruz nor Kasich have a realistic path to getting a majority of delegates before the convention.
Essentially, Ted Cruz is in the same position that John Kasich is in. Then once we get to the convention, the question will be, you know, which candidate can secure a majority of the votes. And I think it'll be much harder for Ted Cruz to secure a majority of delegates than would be John Kasich.
Dent says Cruz appeals less to party regulars and has shown little ability to build personal relationships in the Senate. And he says the personal animosity between Cruz and Trump will make it hard for Trump to win any Cruz delegates, making an open convention more likely. Borick says Cruz supporters have another, more indirect argument for support, that even if you want Kasich to be the nominee, your only hope is an open convention, and that's more likely if Cruz does well in the remaining states.
It's a weird scenario, like everything in this particular election cycle is off kilter. But you may very well support Ted Cruz just to make sure that Donald Trump doesn't get to the magic number, with the assumption that he's not going to be the nominee either, that this is going to be a blocking pattern.
Both Cruz and Kasich are attending a Republican leadership meeting in Hershey Friday. TV ads are bound to follow soon. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie predicts a November ballot question allowing casinos in North Jersey is bound for defeat if the lawmakers don't approve a bill allowing the state to take over Atlantic City's finances.
If the Atlantic City takeover bill and the pilot bill are not passed and sent to my desk in their current form, I will oppose North Jersey Gaming. And I will use every bit of influence I have to make sure that the referendum is defeated.
The governor is pressing the Assembly to vote on the plan, but Assembly Speaker Vincent Prieto refuses to put the measure up for a vote unless Christie drops a provision letting the state break public employee union contracts. Philadelphia's district attorney's office is renewing its push to prevent public school kids from skipping school. The idea is that the threat of criminal charges will keep students in class. Critics say the plan could just make matters worse, as WHYY's Bobby Allen explains.
Over the course of a school year, around 40% of Philadelphia public school students are considered truant or having six or more unexcused absences.
You know, obviously our great concern is the 40%.
The school district's Karen Lynch says it's doing a lot to prevent kids from playing hooky. If a student misses one day, their parents get a robocall. If missing class becomes a pattern, the city's Department of Human Services gets involved.
They look at the social issues that exist in the household that are preventing a child from coming to school on an ongoing basis.
But DA Seth Williams says this approach isn't working. He says if kids are skipping school, they could be getting into trouble. So that's why he'd like to send letters to parents saying if their kid stays chronically truant, his office will press reckless endangerment charges against mom or dad. Michael Churchill with the Public Interest Law Center says that's a bad idea.
Frequently, in fact, it's not the parents who are the problem. Children are independent about whether they go to school or not. And bringing reckless endangerment charges is just a way of increasing the friction with inside the family that probably already exists.
Another skeptic is attorney Alex Dutton with the Education Law Center.
Many of these students are students with disabilities or students with behavioral health challenges that need particularized services.
He says offering those services earlier on, before the issue becomes a crisis, could really help kids stay in school. The DA's office says in a statement that its aim is not to press charges, but to make sure students go to class. A goal all sides agree on, but how to get there depends on whom you ask. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
The Delaware River once supported a thriving manufacturing hub. Now, a group of Philadelphia-area business leaders want to bring that back by using Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale gas. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports on how the plan to turn Philadelphia into an energy hub may not be so easy.
On the surface, it looks simple. Pennsylvania has a lot of shale gas. Bring it to Philly and make things out of it. But the gas is not selling at high prices right now, and producers are slowing down.
The reserves in Marcellus are enormous. And they're trapped there because the market doesn't exist to take those molecules away at a reasonable price.
Phil Rinaldi is chair of the Philadelphia Energy Action Team, and he wants to connect all those idle shale gas molecules with Philadelphia's idle industrial waterfront property. Those sites are already connected to rail lines and, in some cases, pipelines. So use the cheap gas to power heavy manufacturing or use it as the raw ingredient in producing fertilizers or plastics, then get the region's ports humming by shipping the manufactured products overseas. Organized labor loves the idea.
Good jobs, benefits, that's what I see coming out of this.
That's the AFL-CIO's Pat Eiting, who attended a briefing at a Chamber of Commerce event this week on the plan. Jeannie Nevelos with Select Greater Philadelphia was one of the speakers.
53 million people within 200 miles of Greater Philadelphia. If you draw a 200-mile radius around the largest cities in the country, by far we have the largest population density. And that market and where the businesses and the people are is a huge driver. That's where these downstream products need to eventually go.
It's Nevelos' job to sell the plan to manufacturers. But she's got a problem. A lot more gas needs to travel to Philadelphia through pipelines to make this plan a reality. And there's just not enough new pipelines coming on board to supply an industrial renaissance for Philadelphia.
We have to get the interest from the manufacturers, but we have to at the same time grow that pipeline in order to really, really make this sing.
Those manufacturers won't be singing unless they know they're going to have access to the cheap gas. On the other side of the state, the pipeline companies won't build unless they have a guaranteed customer in place. So that puts a kink in Rinaldi's plans.
You know, there's a little frustration here that we're feeling.
Rinaldi's solution to this problem is to get the producers, the people who pump out the gas, to help underwrite the pipelines. But gas companies aren't doing so well these days. With prices so low, they're laying off workers and holding fire sales to get rid of their holdings. Another problem, pipeline projects have to jump through a lot of regulatory hoops, which takes time. Rinaldi says it's a race against the clock to make Philadelphia an energy hub before states along the Gulf Coast take all those molecules down south. Republican Congressman Pat Meehan from Delaware County, who also attended the event, says permits for new pipelines need to be streamlined.
Just to move it along an identified path and not to fall behind so dramatically that investors look and say, I'll go someplace else, I'll go to Texas, and I'll build my jobs there.
But the opposition to new pipelines in Pennsylvania is growing, and a series of current pipeline projects have recently been delayed. This week, Elise Gerhart took to tree sitting risking jail time and injury to protect her property from pipeline construction in Huntington County.
We're talking about already 30,000 miles of planned pipelines in the state. I mean, when's it going to stop? When is it going to be enough for these companies? How many are they going to build?
The Energy Action Team says that depends on what type of factories they can lure to the city. They're now working to prove their plan is something more than just a pipe dream. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Still ahead, a new report spotlights two Philadelphia charter schools for disproportionately suspending special education students.
When a kid has a disability, it costs more and it maybe requires more effort. So if the charter can get rid of kids with disabilities, those kids are going to end up in the school district.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
When college students in Texas head to class, they can take their laptops and their books and now their guns.
What if there is somebody on campus who, you know, wants to use that gun for harmful purposes? If I had to choose a side, I wouldn't want guns on campus.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The new open carry law on campuses in the Lone Star State. That is next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
Moore College of Art and Design supports WHYY and offers part-time evening programs for adults at their convenient Center City campus. Career advancement courses and certificate programs in interior design, print and web design, motion graphics, fashion design, and fashion merchandising are taught by faculty who are working professionals in their fields. Whether building your expertise or beginning a new career path, Moore can help you get ahead. Now accepting registrations for the spring session that begins Monday, April 18th. Moore.edu or 215-965-4030.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The Civil Rights Project at UCLA has flagged two Philadelphia charter schools for suspending special education students at disproportionately high rates. WHYY's Kevin McCrory reports that the schools are among the 10 worst charters in the nation when it comes to this issue.
Anytime a school disproportionately suspends students with special education needs, it raises eyebrows.
When you see that many suspensions, it's a big red flag.
Jennifer Clark, executive director of the Public Interest Law Center, says it can be an indication that schools are not serving kids' needs and then pushing them out because of problems related to their disabilities. The UCLA report, which is based on 2011-12 federally reported data for every school in the country, found that charter schools suspend students with disabilities at a slightly higher rate overall compared to traditional public schools. And in an era where schools need to compete academically to stay open, Clark says this sort of unfair treatment can have its strategic advantages.
When a kid has a disability, it costs more and it maybe requires more effort. So if the charter can get rid of kids with disabilities, those kids are going to end up in the school district.
The two Philadelphia charter schools flagged by UCLA are Philadelphia Electrical and Technical and Esperanza Academy. Philadelphia Electrical and Technical, known as PET, suspended students with disabilities about 25% of the time more than it did the rest of the student body. In fact, special ed students were the only kids that charter suspended that year. PET was founded by the politically influential City Electricians Union, Local 98. The school is on spring break this week and did not return calls for comment. Esperanza Academy Charter High School was also flagged. CEO David Rossi says more recent data flips that disparity on its head, but he also warns against judging a school based on its suspension rate.
Every parent strives to have their student in a safe atmosphere. Every parent strives to have their student, if they do receive discipline, they're restored back into the environment. You'll see that we get high grades on student retention, meaning students that stay with us from year to year. And that's even with our special education students.
Both of these schools had their charters renewed by the School Reform Commission in 2014. And Esperanza was awarded a contract for a new school earlier this year. Kevin McCrory, WHYY News.
Just released in the last hour, Philadelphia, the State of the City, a 2016 update report from the Pew Charitable Trusts. Joining me to help make sense of the numbers is Larry Eichel. He directs Pew's Philadelphia Research Initiatives. Larry, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Great to be here, Dave.
Larry, the big takeaway, the continuing trend of a population loss arrested. Now a growing city undergoing a growing transformation. Now a closer look at this growth, though, points to part of the transformation in the form of growing diversity.
Right. The diversity has been developing for a while. And if you look at it back, say, from a 25-year perspective, in 1990, 91% of Philadelphians identified as either African-Americans or non-Hispanic whites. Today, only 77% of Philadelphians identify as African-Americans or non-Hispanic whites. We have 14% who identify as Hispanic or Latino, 7% Asian, 2% other. That's a very big change.
In a relatively short period of time.
Exactly. And all indications are is that it's going to continue.
Is the change as dramatic when we look at age breakout?
The age breakout, if you look at it more over a shorter period, a 10-year period, in the last 10 years, the country has been getting older. We hear that all the time. We're a graying society. And over the last 10 years, the median age of the country has gone up by a little over a year. In the same period, Philadelphia's median age has fallen by a year and a half. I mean, that's quite a difference. We're now about 4 years younger than the nation as a whole. And what's remarkable about that is all of this comes at a time when in the city and in the country generally, there are relatively few children compared to the previous generation. So this, again, sort of indicates this young adult influx that we've had here, this real increase in the young adult population. It's another manifestation of it. And I think most people would argue youth is a good thing.
Well, let's talk about jobs, both the employment rate relative to other cities in the country and also Philadelphia's place at the top of most impoverished large cities in the country.
Right. You know, we sort of say that in this report that despite these sort of positive transforming signs, the persistent challenges are still large. And obviously the poverty rate is a huge piece of that, a 26% poverty rate. As you said, the biggest among the 10 largest American cities, 400,000 people living below the federal poverty line, a huge problem. And, you know, everybody looks to jobs as part of the way to address that. The number of jobs in the city grew slightly last year. It reached the highest point since 2002. That's a good thing. But the growth rate was quite a bit smaller than the national growth rate. And our unemployment rate on an annualized basis was at 7%, which is, again, quite a bit higher than the national rate and relatively high compared to similar cities.
So the big question, of course, do the trends offer the promise for real progress in tackling the problems we've listed?
Well, we're not in the prognostication business at Pew. These sort of generally positive trends in terms of age, population growth, we've had them for a while now, for the last 8 or 9 years, although at the beginning I think we didn't know they were happening. But I think the question is whether these trends are forming the foundation for real progress on the city's most persistent challenges – poverty, job creation, educational attainment, schools. I think that's the big unanswered question.
In addition to our NewsWorks Tonight audience, who's the intended recipient of this information, specifically who in government or business?
Well, I mean, as with all our work, we are out to sort of inform the public conversation among public officials, civic activists, neighborhood groups, people who are concerned about the city, the news media, and the general public, the people who care about the city. That's our audience.
Larry, thanks so much for shedding light on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
Larry Eichel directs Pew's Philadelphia Research Initiatives. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. We'll also provide a link to the State of the City, a 2016 update report from the Pew Charitable Trusts. Finally this evening, spring is spurring flowers to bloom, and you'd be hard-pressed to find foliage more distinctive than the pink petals of cherry blossom trees. Washington, D.C.'s National Cherry Blossom Festival is in full tilt, but Philadelphia residents needn't travel that far. The Shofuso Japanese House and Garden is alerting Philadelphians that now's peak time to view the cherry blossoms blooming. And to make planning easy, they've released a list of top locations in the city to enjoy the sights. Chauffeuseau's own Fairmount Park Garden topped the list. Other hotspots can be found along Kelly Drive, Martin Luther King Jr. Drive, and near the Please Touch Museum. While peak blossom time may end April 3rd, Chauffeuseau assures that some trees will continue to bloom midway through the month. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Tomorrow evening, we'll visit Philadelphia's Wrestle Factory, where would-be Hulk Hogans learn to compete in the arenas of professional wrestling. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.